Good evening, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening. We're very pleased to have the Chancellor, Gordon Brown, here with us to give the second James Mead Memorial Lecture. James Mead was the leading English economist of his generation, and he made massive contributions to the theory of international economics, for which, of course, he was awarded the Nobel Prize. Most of this work was done while he was at the LSE. He was also one of the founders of the modern theory of public economics, in which objectives of equality are mingled with those of efficiency, with a well-defined trade-off. He inspired many of today's leading economists in Britain and around the world. We're delighted to have Margaret Mead here this evening in the audience with us. There can be no one more fitting to give the James Mead Memorial Lecture than Gordon Brown. The reason is not only that he is Chancellor of the Exchequer, but that he is someone who has thought deeply about how to produce a society that is both prosperous and just. As he was saying so forcefully on the radio this morning, the programme of the current government is well on track to deliver these objectives. According to calculations done here at the LSE, some 2 million people, over half of them children, will have been lifted out of poverty by mid-1992 as a result of the policies which he has instituted. So let me again welcome him here this evening, and say how much we are looking forward to his speech. Gordon Brown.
Tony, ladies and gentlemen, can I say, first of all, I'm delighted to be back here at the London School of Economics, delighted to have been chosen to deliver this, the second Mead Lecture, in honour of the great economist James Mead, delighted that Margaret Mead is with us this evening, and thank her also for her great work on international economic policy and in supporting our campaign to eliminate international debt. And tonight, I want to set out our economic and social goals for our country. I want to detail the long-term strategy we are pursuing to implement them, and I want to review the progress we are making, the difficulties we have had, the next steps in the coming spending review and beyond that we intend as a government to take. To achieve our objectives in a new economy that simultaneously offers greater opportunity and yet threatens greater insecurity, we do require a fresh understanding of the rights and responsibilities of citizens and the reach and the role of government. And it is only with a credible and radical view of citizenship as responsible citizenship and a new view of the state as the enabling state that I believe we can fulfill our historic mission as a Labour government to build a Britain where there is security and opportunity, not just for a privileged few, but for everyone. Now, these objectives were, in my view, at the heart of James Mead's work, which we honour with this lecture this evening. He was in the Treasury in the 1940s. He was a contributor to the White Paper on Full Employment. He was at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1945, which set up the international economic institutions to achieve coordination of international economic policy. And his diaries that show involvement and centrality of his role in these processes. When he gave his inaugural lecture here at the LSE 52 years ago, he said, however, he was more interested in the practical implementation of economic policy than its theory. And I believe that his life work was to show that in a modern economy, efficiency and equality, far from being incompatible, are necessary allies. To achieve these, he sought a modern and fair relationship between individuals, markets, and government. Like us, he wanted to achieve high growth without inflation. Indeed, much of his inaugural lecture at Cambridge was devoted to that. He led the way in seeing full employment as both efficient for the economy and fair for our society. And he saw the best and not just basic public services, especially in health and education, as the key to security and equal opportunity for all. and it is in the spirit of his intellectual contribution to these debates that I want to direct my remarks and my thoughts this evening. And it is a particular pleasure to give this lecture on the 10th anniversary of the Centre for Economic Performance here at the LSE. Not only has this centre done me a great service by Chancellor, as Chancellor, by providing quite a lot of the members of the Monetary Policy Committee, I hope that some future members of the Monetary Policy Committee are with us in the audience this evening, but also it is a tremendous record in research on employment, on fairness, on growth, and I want to pay tribute to its 10th anniversary also. James Mead, as I said, worked in the Treasury, and he knew what the precarious position of the Finance Minister or Chancellor was. Can I say today, with the announcement that we will have yet another new Russian Finance Minister, I have now met 19 Finance Ministers at the G8 conference in only 2.5 years. When I first went to the first meeting of the G8, which is the group of industrial countries that meets every 6 months, even by the time I arrived after the invitations had been put out in 1997, the French finance minister had resigned and we were down to 7. When I went to the second meeting only a few weeks later, such was the precarious position, the Japanese finance minister had been sacked and we were down to 6. In the period of only 1 week, the Italian and the German finance minister went as well. And I now find myself, after only 2.5 years, as the second longest serving finance minister of the G8. And you can see why I don't want to stay away from the Treasury for too long. When I went to Asia, I found as a result of the Asian financial crisis that 14 out of the 15 finance ministers in Asia had been sacked. Of one, it was said what Shelley said about his grandmother, that he had lost the art of communication, but not, alas, the gift of speech. And he went. Another one, of whom it was said that he reported to his cabinet when he proposed devaluation, past policies have led us to the edge of an abyss, and now is the time for a bold step forward. And he went pretty quickly as well. It reminded me of the advice I got when I actually arrived at the Treasury from a senior civil servant. He said, Mr. Brown, he said, there are only two kinds of finance ministers. There are those who fail, and there are those who get out just in time. Now, I want to talk about the course that we are following as a government. The precondition of high employment, higher living standards, and strong public services is economic stability. And we can realise the goals I've set, security and equal opportunity, not just for those born to privilege, but for all, by building on that platform of stability and by meeting our national economic objectives that we are setting as a government for the next decade. The first is our prosperity goal. In place of our historic underperformance as an economy against other countries, we want to see a faster rise in productivity than our competitors over the next decade as we close the productivity gap, and we want therefore to see a fast rise in living standards for all. Our second goal is the full employment goal. In contrast to years in the 70s, 80s and 90s of high mass unemployment, that we have employment opportunity for all in our country in the next decade and a higher percentage of people in work than ever before. Then our educational goal, instead of lagging behind other countries and suffering huge disparities in educational achievements, we ensure educational opportunity for all, aiming for 50% of people going into higher education for the first time in our history, and at the same time as close as possible to 100% of young people with computer skills. Our anti-poverty goal, in contrast to the rise in inequality and poverty we saw over the last two decades, that we ensure that every child in our community has the best possible start in life by halving child poverty in 10 years and abolishing it over the next 20. And in addition, our goal for the public services. Instead of the inheritance that we had, inadequate public services which failed to guarantee opportunity or security for all, that we invest for the future in strong public services that are there for people when they need them. Now, not only the scale of these ambitions, but Britain's legacy of economic underperformance, of social division, of rising inequality, required us in 1997 to reject the short-term quick fix in favour of a consistent long-term strategy. So we have never pretended that Britain's problems could be solved overnight, or that they could be resolved without the need for tough decisions. Indeed, we will not waver, and we must remain single-minded in focusing on these long-term challenges, whether it's in reforming labour, capital and product markets to bridge the productivity gap, or modernising delivery of public services to achieve our health, education and anti-poverty goals. The last few decades teach us, if they teach anything, to reject the short-termism of flawed quick fixes. Policy lurches in face of short-term difficulties rather than taking the tough decisions to achieve long-term economic and social objectives. It is not by populist quick fixes or gesture politics, but by maintaining stability and seeing through long-term modernisation and principled reforms that we will achieve our goals of full employment, prosperity for all, and social justice. And we recognise most of all, and this is my theme tonight, that our goals cannot be achieved by the old methods, either the old methods of old left or the old methods of old right. Indeed, fundamentally, they require a new and modern understanding of the duties of citizenship and the limits and role of government. We reject the old left view, command and control view of government, which mistakenly equated public bureaucracy and public ownership with the public interest, a view that argued that full employment could be achieved simply by old-style demand management policies, and suggests often that the only answer to poverty is to compensate the poor for their situation rather than tackling the underlying causes of poverty. This old and this misguided view of the state, which is irrelevant to a global economy, was accompanied by a failure to place sufficient emphasis on personal responsibility, and I believe instead that our determination to combat social and economic injustice should be matched not by insisting on rights without responsibilities, but by asserting the responsibilities of the individual. So it was an out-of-date view of the relationship between individual and the state that led in the 80s to the right-wing attack on collective provision. Their exclusive reliance on markets, the rejection as evil of any kind of state intervention, the crude dogma of a self-interested individualism which denied there was such a thing as society. For the right, let's be clear, the best government is the least government. Yet abandoning established responsibilities of government, either in economy or in social policy, saying that there was nothing that government could do, it did not improve our productivity performance, but instead it led to more people out of work. It led to a cycle of poor skills, of unemployment, and of deprivation. That was the legacy of absentee government in our country. And it was to step by step tackle these problems of economic inefficiency and social injustice that not only was a new government needed in 1997, but it was given a mandate. And that was and remains our task, a strong economy and a fair society. But to do so, we require a better understanding of the duties of citizenship and the limits and role of government. And I believe that as advocates of social and economic renewal, we should reclaim both the ethic of personal responsibility, as we stress obligations as well as opportunities, and we should affirm the ethic of fairness as we root out economic and social injustice. Take the goal of full employment. We know that it cannot be achieved by the old right ways, simply leaving employment policy to market forces. But we know also it cannot be achieved by the old left method, which was simply by pulling the macroeconomic levers without tackling underlying structural weaknesses in the economy, not least the need for rights and responsibilities in the labour market. And just as we support in the New Deal new opportunities for employment, but new obligations to seize them, so too elsewhere we support responsibilities accompanying rights. New opportunities for an extra 100,000 higher education students, and soon a majority of young people having the opportunity to study in higher education, but new obligations to contribute when earnings as are higher. New help for mothers, a £300 maternity grant, a trebling of the value of the maternity grant when babies are born, but a new responsibility that health checks for the baby are met. New help for teenagers with educational maintenance allowances to enable young people to stay on at school in households where there is poverty and unemployment, but allowances available in return for seeking higher qualifications. New help for adult learning, a break from the old system of training levies or simply doing nothing, with individual learning accounts for 1 million adults, to which government contributes, but the individual contributes too. And with that growth of personal responsibility, we seek the growth of corporate responsibility too. New opportunities for the financial services industries, but in return a new requirement for the openness and transparency that was lacking when pensions were missold. For the environment, new incentives for heavy energy users, matched by a responsibility in the climate change levy we are now introducing to deliver environmental improvements. And in the global economy, which would have interest James Mead because of his involvement in the Bretton Woods Conference, a new responsibility on governments to be transparent in what they do, to be accountable, and to agree a dialogue and a relationship with the private sector, and in return, greater responsibilities on that private sector to contribute their funds to crisis prevention and crisis resolution in the world economy. Whether it be individual or corporate responsibility, our call today is for a responsible citizenship. And we understand what the right still fails to acknowledge in our country, that there is a public interest in securing growth, employment, fairness, and the best public services. But we understand too that this public interest can best be advanced not by allowing the public sector to become a vested interest, but often by the public sector ceasing to be owner and controller and becoming partner, catalyst, sponsor, coordinator, action that empowers rather than directs. Our call is not for big but for better government, what we might call the enabling state. And underlying all this is our understanding of the change world in which we all live. It is a period of great technological advance and opportunity, but it is also, as Tony Giddens in his recent book shows us, a period of unprecedented restructuring and therefore for many millions of people, a period of insecurity as well. And this necessitates a reform in the relationship between individuals, markets, and government. Because more than ever, we need to be able to help people to cope with the insecurities that ever faster change brings. More than ever, we need also as a government to remove the old barriers and let people move ahead. And in the new economy where capital and companies are mobile, we must ensure that we offer the right environment, the best help for business to succeed in every one of the regions of our country and ensure that we have the right competitive environment for growth. So in the new economy, the role of government is neither to obstruct change nor to passively abdicate responsibility for managing the consequences of change. But instead, our role must be to equip people and companies, our country as a whole, to equip it to meet and to master the changes we face. So it is on this basis, an enabling government, encouraging responsible citizenship in pursuit of opportunity for all and security for all, that we will continue to take tough long-term decisions on the side of Britain's hard-working majority. We will do so in our spending review, which will be published in a few months. We will do so in drawing up as a government our next election manifesto, and we will do so if elected in the next Parliament. Now, the first objective that national governments have in a global marketplace is, in my view, to maximise economic stability. We have learnt that monetary and fiscal stability is a necessary precondition in a global economy for national economic success. For in a global marketplace, investment funds will flow to those countries whose policies inspire confidence, and investors will punish mistakes more quickly and more severely than they have ever done in the past. And as a result, both the old Keynesian fine-tuning and the 80s response to it, which was the rigid application of monetarist targets, were policies that were designed for sheltered national economies based on apparently stable and predictable relationships which have now broken down in our modern, liberalized, and global capital markets. So our policy has had to be a new one, to set for a global economy a new long-term framework for monetary and fiscal policy that can command confidence. And its essence is this: that long-term, open, transparent decision-making procedures, which command credibility, provide a better route to stability than fixed monetary or exchange rate rules. And that's why, when we came into power in 1997, we immediately, in our first few days, put in place a radically different monetary framework based on imposing consistent rules, a symmetrical inflation target, which is pro-growth, settled and well-understood procedures, Bank of England independence, and an openness and transparency that required the institutions to report properly to the public. And side by side with this, and as important, was a radically changed fiscal discipline with, again, clear and consistent rules, the golden rule on public spending, well-understood procedures, fiscal responsibility legislation, and here too, a new openness and a new transparency. And I believe that as a country, we are already seeing in greater stability the rewards of creating Bank of England independence and our new fiscal disciplines. And it's because we sought to learn from the mistakes that had been made in the last 40 years, where boom and bust followed one after another, that this government will maintain its prudent and tough approach. And we must be determined to avoid the old British mistake of paying ourselves too much today at the cost of higher interest rates and fewer jobs tomorrow. I understand the great difficulties that the current fall in the euro is causing for British industry, especially for manufacturing industry. Such a euro-sterling exchange rate cannot be justified by any view of long-term economic fundamentals. But manufacturers who have in this country suffered from boom and bust over the last 30 years and from the short-term policy lurches, which all too often went wrong, would also reject a return to the short-term quick fix, which would put at risk the long-term stability, which is the foundation we are creating for steady growth, investment, and job creation. Now, stability is a necessary precondition to deliver our objectives for our country, but it is not sufficient. An economy cannot fly on only one wing, and that is why microeconomic as well as macroeconomic reform, or supply-side reform of the economy, is also essential to raising our prosperity as a country. Now, some people, indeed, it has been an academic debate for years, argue that governments working with business cannot improve the productivity levels of the economy. But I would reject this pessimistic view. Of course, businesses create wealth, managers and workforces create jobs and higher output, but governments must ensure that the environment within which wealth and production is created is one that favours competition and not vested interests or monopolies, and it must ensure that the economy is properly functioning labour, capital and product markets. 50 years of economic history from 1945, marred by a succession of sterile and often self-defeating conflicts between state and market, managements and workforces, public and private sectors, also taught us the need for a national economic purpose, an end to short-termism, and the need for all, industry, the financial community, and government, to take a long-term view. Industry, by investing for the long term. The financial community, by refusing to resort to the short-termism and the stop-go attitudes which have bedeviled us since the war. And government, by not only ensuring lasting stability, but taking seriously its responsibilities to remove the barriers to productivity, job creation, and growth. So while 30 years ago, in that Labour government then, governments responded to the productivity challenge with top-down plans, tax incentives, grants, primarily in the 60s for physical investment. Today, the role of government is more complex. It is the encouragement of competition, so we remove vested interests. It is the modernisation of capital and labour markets. It is the encouragement of science and innovation and an enterprise culture open to all, so that British industry, manufacturing and services can close our productivity gap and deliver higher profits, investment, employment and growth. And our productivity push, which has led to a new research and development tax credit, which has led to regional venture capital funds, to a new independent competition authority, to the biggest ever $1.4 billion investment in science, to a new university challenge fund, and to new institutes of enterprise across our country based around our universities. That productivity push will be stepped up in the coming year. We will build on the measures we have already introduced. We are examining for the professions. The Office of Fair Trading is now working through a detailed remit to examine how best to ensure that the rules of professional bodies do not restrict or distort competition and therefore diminish our economic performance. For banking, having accepted the main recommendations of Cruikshank, we will legislate to ensure the UK payment system is open to new competition. In our capital markets, we must ensure there are no barriers to competition and innovation, no closed circles, no unnecessary constraints restricting investment decisions, and that investors have every opportunity and encouragement to back the dynamic small and growing companies in manufacturing and in services in every region of our country. This is not city and industry as before working against each other, nor the old battles between public and private sector, but city, industry and government together playing their part in promoting industrial growth. And that is why, following the Cruikshank report, I've asked Paul Miners, who is the chairman of Gartmore and indeed the Guardian newspaper, to head a review of institutional investment to cover all these issues. Institutional investors in our country have a vital role to play. They control around 45% of quoted equity investments, and Mr. Miners will report back in time for action in the next budget. In this way, we are removing the old barriers to underinvestment in our country and the neglect that has too long held our regions back. Working with the new regional development agencies and our new small business service, our aim must be balanced economic development across the regions and the nations of the United Kingdom. And that is a modern regional policy supporting local innovation, more investment, and improved infrastructure. And having launched a £1 billion network of regional venture capital funds, John Prescott and I will, in the coming spending review, announce further measures that will strengthen the work of regional development agencies in innovation, investment, and employment growth. Now, when we came to power in 1997, we also put the restoration of the work ethic at the centre of our social and economic policy. Our aim for the next decade is something that has not been achieved for more than 40 years, and that is employment opportunity for all, with a higher proportion of people in our country offered the chance of employment and being employment than ever before. And to help this, we are building a new and modern welfare state, one that, in addition to its traditional and necessary function of giving security to those who cannot work, promotes work, makes work pay, and gives people the skills they need to get better jobs. And I think most people know that in the last 20 years, unemployment has become the primary cause of poverty in Britain. Simply compensating people for their poverty through benefits is not enough. The task must be to deal with the causes of poverty. So we are putting in place a long-term strategy to help those sections of the population excluded for far too long. The young unemployed, the long-term unemployed, lone parents, and disabled men and women who can work, want to work, but who have, for years have been denied the right to work. Now, already over 400,000 young people have joined the New Deal that we set up in 1997. Almost 200,000 young people have found jobs, and the vast majority of these still have these jobs. A further 120,000 have already gained valued experience on New Deal options, and over 70,000 employers have signed up to the New Deal. So I'm indeed very grateful to the privatised utilities who paid over to me cheques worth £5 billion to make possible the start to the New Deal. Since the election, as a result of this, youth unemployment has halved. And because we have succeeded in this Parliament in removing the old barriers to employing the young, from April next year, we are going to extend the opportunities of the New Deal to the long-term adult unemployed as well. Four options for work: work-based training, work experience, self-employment, work experience in the voluntary sector, but no fifth option, no staying at home, doing nothing. And this relationship we are forging between rights and responsibilities is firmly rooted both in economic opportunity and in individual responsibility. In Britain, unlike many other comparable countries, unemployment among lone parents is over 50%. Starting nationally from next April, lone parents with children over five who attend work-focused interviews will find out about new choices that we are making available to them. The choice to train for work with a new cash payment, the choice of a few hours work a week with the first £20 of earnings allowed with no reduction in benefit, the choice of part-time work with a guaranteed minimum income of £155 for 16 hours of work, or the choice of full-time work on a guaranteed £214 a week, or £11,000 a year. And on every rung of this ladder of opportunity, there will be new help with childcare from the development of a national childcare strategy. So our aim is to create a ladder of opportunity with government on the side of working people as they seek and find jobs, and in many cases consider self-employment and starting a business. And to sustain that goal of full employment, we also need, as everybody knows, to ensure that work pays. When we came into power, there was no minimum wage. The tax and benefit system was unreformed. Many of those without work faced an unemployment trap where work paid far less than benefits. And the low paid in work faced a poverty trap, which meant they faced marginal tax and benefit rates of 80%, 90%, or even over 100% for every extra pound they earned. So to tackle this, we needed to combine a sensible and prudent minimum wage with a generous and fair system of in-work support. And all the measures we have introduced, the 10 pence starting rate of tax, the 22 pence basic rate, the reform of national insurance with lower rates for those who are low paid, the new children's tax credit, which will be introduced next year, and the most important innovation that is at the centre of it, the working families tax credit, are the building blocks of this new strategy to make work pay. Already over 1 million people are receiving the working families tax credit. And that means that every working family with someone working full time is today guaranteed a minimum income of £200 a week, and it will be £214 from next year. And as a result of these measures, the family on half average earnings will be £2,500 a year better off in real terms next year compared to 1997. It will mean a rise in living standards for that family this year alone of 20%. And that is, for the low paid in our country, the biggest improvement in living standards for a generation. So while the old tax system simply set a personal allowance that failed to ensure that for the person in work, work paid, and it also even made thousands of people pay tax even as they claim benefits, we are putting in place a new, more progressive tax system that encourages and rewards work. So instead of a personal tax system that has rates from 40% to 20% and then zero, we now have a tax and benefit system with rates from 40% to 10%, the lower personal rate of tax, and then as a result of the working families tax credit, to as low as minus 200% of earnings of around £60 a week. And there, for every pound people earn, up to £2 is paid in working families tax credit. And our next step in this radical tax and benefit reform, which is to make work pay and is to ensure that working families with children are far better off, some better off by £50 a week since last October, our next step is to extend that principle of the working families tax credit, because barriers to work across the workforce are different for different groups, for families with children, for those without children, for older workers, and for single people. And from 2003, we will introduce an employment tax credit that is paid through the wage packet, which will be available to households without children as well as households with children. And as a first step, we have begun this April with an employment credit, which is a minimum income guarantee for those people who are over 50 who are returning to work. Now, full employment, as I said at the beginning, is within our grasp, but it is not just the right to work. It is where there are jobs and where people are able to work, the responsibility and the requirement to work. So as we extend opportunities to those who are out of work, we will extend the responsibility to take up the work on offer. The informal or hidden economy in our country is now draining billions of pounds in fraudulent benefit claims and unpaid taxes. And this loss of revenues, this incidence of fraud, this waste of resources cannot be allowed to continue, and especially when there are jobs that benefit claimants could take. And that is why we're implementing the report of the chairman of the LSE, Lord Grabner, QC, And I can confirm that we will legislate to tackle benefit fraud. We will take powers in the finance bill for a new statutory offence of fraudulent tax evasion, and that will enable the Inland Revenue to prosecute in the Magistrates' Court those who evade the responsibilities. New opportunities, matched by new responsibilities, are also at the heart of our education policy. And by the end of our coming decade, our goal is not the old 10% of students in higher education as we saw in the 60s, or the 20% that we saw in the 70s and 80s, but more than 50% of young people, the majority of young people leaving school, able to enter higher education. And in addition to the investment in higher standards in schools and colleges and universities that will be announced in the spending review in the next few weeks, let me emphasize that we want to make equal opportunity count for thousands of people who have previously been left out of the education system by the creation of individual learning accounts so that adults can engage in lifelong learning, by the creation of the University for Industry, which will do for non-university courses what the Open University did for university courses from the 1960s onwards. And in particular, I want to emphasize the extension of educational maintenance allowances, which will be up to £40 a week in our highest unemployment communities. Higher rates of staying on in education are our aim, and in return for young people pursuing higher qualifications by staying on at school, we will provide new cash support to them, once again an enabling state in schools, encouraging and rewarding effort by young people. Now, our goal is not simply full employment and that 50% of young people are able to benefit from higher education. Our goal is that every child in our community has the best possible start in life. Ending child poverty in 20 years, halving it in 10 years. And it is because the scale of the injustice over the last 20 years has been so great that we have already taken action to lift 1.2 million children in our community out of poverty. If only one child that I saw unemployed in my if only one child that I saw in poverty in my constituency, in a family where the adult was unemployed, had been lifted out of poverty by the action that we've taken, then in my view, that would have been worthwhile. But to see 1.2 million children in our country lifted out of poverty as a result of actions that we have been able to take is the biggest spur to further effort in the future. It is the biggest anti-poverty program in a generation. And we are not only investing in higher child benefit, which has been raised by 30%, in the working families tax credit, which is worth £50 more to many low-income families, but we are also investing in a new Sure Start program, which is to give in the poorest areas of our communities the youngest children the best possible support in education, in health, and in other areas, so that they can have a far better start in life. Now, in the Child Poverty Action Group lecture that I'm giving next Monday, I'm going to set out new measures to fight the war against child poverty, showing how we plan to tackle social injustice and extend opportunity in new ways. We recognize that the war against child poverty cannot be won by government or by parents alone, and it depends on engaging community action in our country, the voluntary and charitable sector, and in both our Sure Start programs and in a new children's fund that we are setting up. We will devolve power from national and local government to community-based organizations to help them engage in the war against child poverty. And we will match new opportunities with new responsibilities and give additional help to mothers when their babies are born. It is our determination in the next 10 years to halve the numbers of children in poverty on the road to abolishing child poverty in 20 years. And we know it is the combination of greater financial help, greater investment in the poorest areas where there is the highest unemployment. It is engaging the community action sector in this battle against child poverty. It is improving education, and it is in setting up the best possible national strategy for childcare that we are going to achieve our aims. And just as we have a long-term strategy to tackle child poverty, and we have made a start and must do more, so too pensioner poverty. As a result of the measures we've introduced since 1997, we will be spending £6.5 billion more over the Parliament supporting pensioners. We are actually spending more than we would have spent if we had simply restored to pensioners the earnings link. But we are spending it in a fairer way because our first priority is to end pensioner poverty. As I said in the budget, based on forecast rates of inflation, we expect the basic state pension in April 2001 to rise by over £2 and for couples by over £3. All pensioners benefit from the new winter fuel allowance raised to £150 for the coming winter and from the measures like free TV licences for the over 75s and the minimum income guarantee that has helped the poorest pensioners most. So our first priority has been to tackle pensioner poverty. And taking these measures together, 1 million pensioners, the poorest pensioners in our country, will be up to £20 a week better off than they were in 1997. Now, the next stage for us is to ensure that pensioners are not penalised for their savings or for their thrift. And therefore, we must do more for pensioners with modest occupational pensions and small savings. And later in the year, Alistair Darling, the Social Security Secretary, will be consulting on a measure for the next Parliament, the new pensioners' credit. This will do more for those with modest occupational pensions and savings, who should, as I say, not be penalised for having worked hard all their lives and saved for the retirement. Our determination, having tackled pensioner poverty, is to make sure we help all those pensioners who have modest incomes. Now, in all these initiatives to meet our productivity, employment, education and anti-poverty goals, our approach is driven by this desire to match opportunity and security, and it is underpinned by continuing with reform. And this approach will also be at the heart of this year's spending review as we build public services that make people more secure, something that is even more important in today's world of rapid economic uncertainty and change, where people rightly look to government to ensure that there is more security. In the last spending review, we recognised that to achieve these objectives in the health service, in education, in transport, in the infrastructure of our country, both the role of government and the management of spending and investment has to change. And we broke from the annual cycle that was short-termist and wasteful. Now, in this review, we will extend our reforms further. We will match new investment with further modernisation. With our focus on results, we are breaking down the old incrementalism that concentrated on inputs and not results. With our commitment to cross-cutting reviews and decisions to target public spending on priority policy areas, irrespective of departmental boundaries, we are breaking down the crude departmentalism that led in public spending to duplication and waste. With the doubling of public investment, we are breaking from the old focus on consumption alone as we seek to equip Britain for the future. And with our public-private partnerships extended, we are ending the old public-private split. This approach is for a purpose, to ensure that department by department, we implement our commitments in this review to meet our three objectives: to extend opportunity for all people, to create a fairer Britain, and to invest in our future. And already we are showing that with our commitment to the NHS, the largest ever sustained increase in NHS funding, 6% real terms rises a year for the next 4 years, and the intensive review of the NHS, which the Prime Minister is leading, that we are matching money with modernisation. And I'm convinced that with the tough decisions we make, we can also meet our priorities, not just in health, but in our other key priorities, including additional money for education, criminal justice, transport, and tackling social exclusion in return for reforms in these areas. So my message this evening is that we are determined to stay the course of reform and modernisation to achieve our objectives. The way forward is through an enabling government which encourages responsible citizenship and aims for security and equal opportunities for all. This is the key to lasting change in our country, and it is the key to a stronger, fairer Britain. And I say to this audience, in the spirit of James Mead, who never lost confidence in the future, that we must never lose sight of our ambition, that we can root out injustice, that we can tackle inequalities, that we can change our country for the better, that we can make this country a far fairer and a far more equal society. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thanks for the mention.